you know, acres and acres of land, and it's hundreds of kids, and it's kids being taken care of kids. It's a big job. And I'll come to the camp and I'll meet with the kids and I'll speak and blah, 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 blah. I'm just about ready to go. I'm exhausted. It's 2 in the morning. So I grab my head back. And then invariably someone will say, how do we go on with camp? How do we have color war? How do we have the cantata, the play, after this tragedy? And this is a very common feeling. And might be a sentiment that some of you guys may have. Like, you may feel guilty that you're going on with life. You're having a good time, you're growing and progressing, and Ezra's not. And that may weigh on your mind. So I'll tell you what I tell them, and this is a very important and interesting, very important for you guys to hear. This is a little heavy, I apologize, but I think it's relevant, so I'll share it with you. There are some people, you know, the two types of situations when there is a death. They're the ones like with Ezra, where it's sudden and tragic. And there wasn't an opportunity sort of to say goodbye. But there are other situations where the person who's dying, even sometimes older person, but let's say even a younger person who's dying, they die of an illness and it's a gradual deterioration. And there is an opportunity to say goodbye. One of the things that I do in my work in bereavement is I do something called pre-bereavement, which is, that's a very moving experience, I'll tell you, very moving experience, where I orchestrate a goodbye. I meet the family and I have the family meet with the person. And they say their last goodbye. Very moving. Very, very, sometimes as a group, sometimes individually. There's a very common theme that the person who's dying gives over to the survivors pretty consistently. And that theme is, you go on living. They all want that. In fact, it's not uncommon when there's a young spouse, again, we shouldn't know from it, but when a young spouse dies, very often the message to the surviving spouse is, get remarried. In fact, sometimes they even tell them who to marry. Usually not someone as pretty as they are, but you know, they'll tell them. Marry, and some of them do. I've had situations like that where they listen to the dying spouse and they marry the person that he or she says. But very consistently, the people who are leaving this world want the survivors, want the friends, and want the loved ones to go on living. I'll never forget once family that I was working with, a child who was not yet 4 years old, who was almost four. And the last thing he said before he lapsed into a coma to his family, to his sibling, well, only one sibling at the time, and his parents was, don't be sad, be happy like me. That was the last thing he said to his family. At 3 3/4, he had that insight also that he wanted, knew something and he wanted people to be happy. And I think it's very important for all of you to realize, and I've gotten to know Ezra this week, and I have to say the Schwartzes were amazing, and I do this work a lot. They didn't hold back at all. Besides the pictures and the letters and the stories, I got to know Ezra this weekend that I didn't know before. And by the way, that's not something to minimize. That's an amazing accomplishment and a real tribute both to Ezra, to community, and to them. But having gotten to know Ezra, as the rabbi called him, the magnet, he was a very happy, very fun-loving, he is a very happy and fun-loving person, and very kind, very dedicated to his friends. I am sure that he's up there in Gan Eden, he's saying, guys, you know, go out there, have fun, party, go date, you know, go on with your careers, play ball. He wants that. And one of the ways in which you can honor him is to do just that. And certainly if there is hesitation facing this because of any kind of guilt, and that guilt does happen. We call it sometimes survivor guilt. There's a thing, very interesting thing called witness guilt, which I'm very much subject to. Witness guilt is when I go to intervention, I don't think of a situation where a child died, I feel guilty that it happened to them, it didn't happen to me. A very common response for bereavement trauma people. But if that is, if that's operative, that's by the way what I say to the people in the camp, which is I say to them that, well, again, let's say it was Ezra. I'll say to them, well, what does Ezra want? And they'll say, well, of course he wants us to. And that's very much, and by the way, anytime I'm dealing with someone who because of that kind of guilt is not living, is not going on, I don't use it often, but it is a very powerful intervention. And as I said, it's very consistent. people who leave this world really want those who are here to continue and to continue living and going on. Should I keep going? Is this okay? Want me to stop? Is there any questions about anything? No? Okay, so let me talk a little bit.
Any questions? Clarifications?
Okay. So let me... go ahead.
Okay.
So let me tell you a little more about maybe some of the things you guys are going through, and then, as I said, jump in at any time. First of all, this was a traumatic event, and there are two types of trauma. There's primary trauma and there's secondary trauma. Primary trauma is the trauma of the people to whom this immediately happened. The boys in the van who were there when the shooting took place, that's primary trauma. You could even say that maybe for all of you guys, or for many of you guys, it was primary trauma. Secondary trauma is when you hear about it. When it hit, when you weren't present, or you weren't, let's say even if you weren't even that close to us, or weren't in his yeshiva with him, but you found out. That's secondary trauma. By the way, it's a Rashi and Chumash. So we do a little learning, okay? In the Shira, it says, Tipolo hem ematava fachad. And Rashi says, Emata ala rechokim, pachad ala krovim. Emata were the people who saw the drowning of the Egyptian army. Emata were the ones who read about it in the Moabite Times. But there is such a thing as secondary trauma too, and most of you guys are somewhere in between, I guess, are experiencing primary and secondary trauma. So that was about, that's the informing, that was the notification. And trauma is a frightening experience, and secondary trauma has the same reactions as primary, just not quite as strong. And it has a staying power, that when you experience trauma, it doesn't leave you so easily. Now, some people get really stuck in it, and there's that thing called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't think any of you have that. Post-traumatic stress disorder is usually the soldiers who day in and day out had this kind of horrific events and seeing that. But someone like yourself who was a one-time event, you're probably not, it's not a disorder in that it's interfering with your functioning. But the memory of finding out, or the memory of those of you who were there of being in the airport for that part of it, that's going to stay. And it's going to be with you in a very vivid kind of way. Trauma has a way of sort of staying very alive. Sometimes people get flashbacks. And now if that's happening to any of you, flashbacks are usually when you're relaxed, you're kind of chilling, sometimes very often when before you go to sleep, and suddenly you get an image. You know, you might see something very suddenly, or you might hear something, you might be brought back to it. That can happen. And that's normal, very normal, but it has a very powerful staying power. And if you do get flashbacks, if let's say it does come back to you a lot, then that's usually a message from the brain that you need to deal with it. Which means you need to talk about it, you need to process it, you need to think about it, maybe write about it. But it's usually a message. By the way, that could go for this and go for any other trauma. The statistics are pretty high that at some point or another in someone's life they will experience a trauma. It could be a car accident, could be witnessing a violent act, for any number of things. It could be an attempted violent act on you. But if that happens, and if the images and the memories may come back, if they do, that's a message that you have to deal with it. That's the trauma piece. The grief piece is that someone you love and someone you care about is not here. Our life is a web of relationships. Relationships are all that matters. I'll tell you we'll do another Dvar Torah, okay? Another short one. Everybody's familiar with Eov, right? Mm-hmm. So you know the story of Eov, right? The story of Eov is that Satan goes around the world, right? And comes back and God's talking, God says, did you see my servant Eov, and he said, isn't he a God-fearing, good person? So the Satan challenges God and said, yeah, take away everything but his life, and let's see how religious he'll be. So God does that. He gets sick with boils, he loses all his fortune, all his children die, he loses everything. That all happens, like, I think in the first paragraph, or in the first chapter. The rest of the book is his three friends who come to visit him, and they have a conversation. three fat, that's on the basis of Shiva. They come to visit him and they have to come. That's the whole rest of the book, because it's like, I think it's like about 50 chapters or something, right? So the Bali Musar asks a very good question. If you're supposed to lose everything except your life, why does he have friends? He should have lost his friends. Oh, baby, I lose friends all the time. I'm very good at it. So why does he still have friends? And the answer is, if you don't have friends, you don't have a life. Friends are not expendable. Friends are oxygen. Our contact, our people, our relationships are oxygen. By the way, his wife also. She has a very small role in the book, but he doesn't lose her either. But, that's essential to life. And so when a friend is not here, there's something missing. Something, it's almost like, sometimes people talk about it like losing a limb. Something very essential, because Ezra had a role in your lives. He had a part in all of your lives, and that part is not here, and that causes the grief reaction that we have. And the grief reaction is, as you know, is sadness, pining, missing him, and the aching. And also, by the way, a lot of you probably are also grieving for the Schwartz family, because you're sensitive enough and mature enough to know what this meant, the enormity of the tragedy to them. So you're also hurting for your friends, for your friends' parents, and for the siblings as well. The rule of thumb with grief is, first of all, grief. Well, I think grief usually comes, if it comes, it comes in waves. Even for the immediate family, it's not like all. It's, to some extent, for them, it's always there. But it comes, it comes to the forefront, it recedes, it comes to the forefront, it comes in, but you know, sort of in stages, sort of. So some of you maybe periodically, it may come to the forefront, you may think about it, you may be talking about it, it may get you sad, and other times it may recede in the background. Again, to reiterate what I said before, probably less and less so now, and that's normal, not anything for you to feel guilty about. But and the reason, by the way, why it happens that way is because we're kind of, you know, we're programmed to deal with things. By the way, this goes for other things in life also, to deal with it in bite-sized portions. So sometimes if we would have every painful thing that happens come to us all at once, we'd fall apart. So it comes in bite-sized portions. If it does, and if the feelings are consuming and the feelings are difficult, there's a very easy solution. It's not, try to push it out of your head, not to try to do something to distract you. The best approach is to talk. Talk, even just to write it down, but to give a call. Call one another, call one of your other friends. Call your parents, call Rochester's, call me. I mean, you don't know me, but you know, just talk. And the interesting thing is, just talking about it makes it better. I will tell you a study, and I'll tell you an interesting experience I've had. They did a study after 9/11. They took some of you who survived the Twin Tower attack, and they hooked them up on a PET scan, I think it was, to be able to see the activity of the brain. And they asked them to remember what happened to them. Did we talk about this study when you were in my class?
Might have, I forgot.
Might have, I know it's David Pelkins' favorite, but okay. And they asked them to remember what happened. And the part of the brain that lit up was the amygdala, the most primitive parts of the brain, the part of the brain that we share with the animal kingdom, which is all emotions and fear and everything like that. Then the guy who did this was a fellow, Basil van der Kolk. He's probably the foremost fellow in the neuroanatomy of trauma. Then he said to them, now tell me what happened. Let's talk about it. And as they talked about it, you could literally see the activity in the brain shift from that very primitive part of the brain, which is by the brain stem all the way in, to the frontal cortex, to the Broca's center, which is the most advanced part of the brain, the part of the brain that separates us from the animal kingdom, part of the brain that deals with logic and language, etc. So just talking, just expressing yourself, takes it away from that very, you know, primitive, difficult part of your brain, and puts it in the part of the brain that gives you control. I will tell you that I have patients coming to me who have been traumatized. They'll come to my office, and I'll sit down, they'll tell me what happened. They'll tell me, or if they had a terrible loss, they'll tell me, and they'll cry, and I barely do a thing. maybe I'll ask a question or two for clarity, but I just listen to them. And afterwards, they'll tell me, oh, that was a great session, you were so helpful. And I feel like a charlatan. I feel like a faker. What did I do? You know, I mean, you guys could have done it, right? You didn't. What was the big deal? You just sit there and listen. First of all, sitting and listening is not so easy, especially some of this kind of stuff. But still, the very fact that I gave them an opportunity and I gave them a context to talk made it more manageable. So again, the tragedy may come back, you might have flashbacks, you may have reminders, you might feel guilty. You may feel guilty that your life is going on, his life is not. You might come back here to Sharon and see, have all the reminders now about Ezra, which you didn't have, and wherever you are on campuses, etc. If it comes up, give it a voice, give it expression, and it will help. Any questions about that? Anything that I've spoken about that makes sense, doesn't make sense? It's all okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions about this that you want to ask me about the trauma, about grief in general? About psychology? Not really. All right. Again, I'll just mention one or two other things and then, you know, we can leave it over. Again, I don't want to keep you guys. I'm sure there's many other things you want to do tonight that might even be more entertaining than this, but hard to imagine, but, you know, I always, that's one of my standard lines I always say, is that this is why I don't get invited to parties, because people ask me what I do for a living, and the party's over, you know, so I'm not exactly. I remember once I was getting ready for the bereavement weekends that I run, and my kids are very big readers, all of them, and one of my kids comes popping down the stairs and says, oh, Abby, got anything good to read? And then she goes in front of where I'm sitting with, you know, surviving the death of your child, not letting death destroy you, you know, proper responses to death, you know, and she, oh, you're such a downer, she was like. So I'm used to this. But at any rate, a nice thing to do, and that can be helpful, is something yourself, some cause, if you will, or some undertaking in memory of Ezra. And by the way, it does not have to be anything huge. I know sometimes I get calls, random calls, people I don't even know. They'll say, you know, my neighbor just lost a child. What can I do for them? One of the things I'll tell them is, you know, take on a good deed. It can be a very small, the smallest little thing. Take on a mitzvah. Decide that, you know, from now on, you're going to have Shal Shuddis and Shabbos instead of just skipping it. Or you're going to say one extra little paragraph of Tehillim on Shabbos. Something very small in that person's memory, and go tell them. And every time you do it, think about that person. That is a tremendous comfort to the family, and it can be a very big comfort to you. Because what happens with death is, death, when we face something, especially when we take a situation like Ezra's, it really makes us question the meaningfulness of life, makes us question God. I mean, we had a whole conversation about that earlier. It seems so senseless, and it is. From our vantage point, the tragedy of Ezra's death is just total senselessness. It sort of throws us back into what philosophers call nihilism, you know, it's like meaninglessness. So sometimes to help us believe in the inherent goodness of life, despite this, we have to do something also that just chips away from the senselessness of these losses. Rabbi Soloveitchik, again, who I always have to mention here in the Boston area, explains the custom of aniness in this way. I don't know if you're familiar with the laws of Avelis, but when an immediate relative dies, until the person is buried, the immediate relatives, let's say it's an older parent, the children are pater from mitzvot. They don't have to do any mitzvot. I remember when my parents, it takes them getting used to, because like you wanna make a bracha, you're not supposed to because you're an onay. You know, you're not supposed to think, you can't do negative precepts. You can't like be mechal Shabbos or things like that, but positive things you don't do. And then comes the Shiva and all the mitzvot of the Shiva. And so Rabbi Soloveitchik explains that captures the experience of death, because your immediate experience is nothing's meaningful. And what's meaningful, we define meaningfulness by mitzvot. Then, after the burial, then we reclaim meaningfulness by doing the mitzvot. And that's something that you guys, if it's helpful to you, something you can think about. And it should be related to Ezra. And it doesn't have to be, it could be a charity, it could be raising money, it could be something religious, it could be just a general good deed. You can just decide, you know what, I have a neighbor who's a lonely old woman, I'm going to smile at her and say hello. Because as a memory of Ezra's upbeat personality. These are things, and it's a right thing to do in a sort of spiritual sense, but it also helps you. It makes you feel better. It also keeps in a way Ezra alive. It keeps sort of lets you know that in a way that he still has a presence here, that the world is a little bit of a better place now because of him. I think that's about as much as I think I want to say to you. I'm opening it up if there's something I didn't address that somebody wants to ask or just wants to ask about psychology, being a psychologist. Anybody want to be a psychologist? Anybody doing mental health stuff? Smart group. All right.
I'd be curious to learn a little bit about some projects. I know Ariel and I spoke a little bit about a softball or baseball tournament that might be organized. I think I spoke about it with you and Ben about a 5K run at Rutgers.
He was going to go to Rutgers, right?
Yeah. Just as the rabbi of the show, people sort of come to me all the time saying, like, are there projects, are there things happening to sort of, you know, sustain the legacy of Ezra. So I'd be curious to just learn from you if there are things happening or that you're interested in.
It's not just the 5K. I mean, I don't even know what the 5K. I know last year there was a 5K run. There's always a 5K run at Rutgers, and they just happened to make it in memory of him last year. This year there's some kind of thing on Friday night. It's coming Friday night that I'm not having anything to do with. They just asked me to speak, but it's like the Chabad and Hillel are trying to put together something for him. This coming Friday, yeah. It's probably not going to happen because they're arguing over where to have it and really stupid politics, but...
Love shows.
I know. Uh-huh. But that's what the plan is.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard anything about this baseball tournament, or...?
Not really.
Yeah.
No.
I think Ari and Ruth are working on it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Who didn't play on the team with him? Played? Mm-hmm. Okay. Have you stayed in touch with the coach a little?
Actually, not really.
Mm-hmm.
He's still coach?
Yeah. My family's still in touch with him because my brothers were. Well, Donnie's still in touch.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Other Donnie.
Is it the Maima team?
Yeah.
Maima
baseball team.
Yeah.
Ezra was very close with his coach.
Uh-huh.
Are there other like projects or small things that you're aware of or you're thinking of?
That learning thing, it's almost done. Who put together Shashmas Nayot? Like last year, they put together, they're going to finish Shashmas
Nayot. For his year site, yeah.
Yeah.
I think,
signed up for Pesachim, so I don't know.
Uh-huh. I think it was his yeshiva that put that together.
Yeah, it was in the community.
It was in the community here?
A lot of people did it.
Schaefer, maybe?
Oh, yeah, it might have been. He often does that, yeah.
Yeah, the thing you can do, by the way, which is also, you know, talk about it. You know, make a new friend, you're going out with someone, a new relationship, you know. Not always 24 hours, because then they'll think you have some bereavement specials, not because I'm invited to parties, but, you know, just from time to time. I want to tell you something interesting. My brother-in-law was in a very bad car accident. He was bad, and he survived. And I obviously never knew this question, but I've heard so much about him from my brother-in-law and from my wife that I know him. To me, he's alive. And